Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, good. I guess it would be good morning, good afternoon for some of us. Mark, how are you doing? I'm enjoying a little bit of sun here on the Riviera, but I tell you, I would never miss an ortho. I'd never miss an ortho Joe in a conversation with you. So, how's it going?
Well, it's going good. I've got the mug, which I think at least one of our guests has got one of these. I'm not sure what the policy is on sending a guest a second one of these for fear of illegal sales on eBay and things, raising revenue for an individual. But anyway, it's empty because it's mid afternoon here and our guests are in several time zones, so we've got I think already well caffeinated from other sources. So, but great to see you. Looks like you've been using sunscreen there in sunny Mexico, or at least staying under umbrellas or something like that. But I don't feel jealous at all. I'm just here doing clinical work, the usual stuff. But we have a great couple of guests. Who it was my notion to get them to speak about their outstanding database work. We've got Kano Okiki, who is on the editorial board. He is our DEI deputy editor. And we've got Dr. Navarro, who is our evidence-based orthopedics deputy editor, members of our editorial board. But both work in the Kaiser Permanente system. And what we want to talk with them about is just the outstanding work that's coming out of the KP database. And of course, Dr. Okiki has been doing a lot of work with trauma and arthroplasty, but I'd like to start with Ron. Can you give our listeners a notion about how these databases started? I believe you spent your entire career with KP after your fellowship with Dr. Fu. So tell us how these databases got started.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. And thanks for having Kanu and I on. This is a real honor for me to be able to be talking to both of you. Back in the early 2000s, I joined Kaiser Permanente in 1997. And from 97 to 2000, there were a group of us, a core group of us that were going to orthopedic meetings and saying, wow, the big academic programs that they are really dominating the podium. And we would like to kind of envision a way to become a little bit more well-known. So in some ways, a little bit of this was selfish, but we're at a meeting up in Big Bear, California. It's the kind of the lame little mountain of skiing above Los Angeles. It takes longer to get to there, and you're typically carsick when you get there. And we were up at a meeting. It was a sports medicine meeting. And a couple of us, notably Don Fithian, who's a really great thinker, and Tad Funahashi, as well as a person who worked with Don, Liz Paxton, were all there. And a number of others, Greg Malik, who's a big stalwart in our registries as well. We're sitting and we kind of back of napkins said, hey, we should start doing a registry much like the Europeans do. And so long and short, Liz and Don went out to Sweden and Gothenburg and got to meet with some of the people who'd been running the largest and oldest registry in the world there, the Swedish registry, and really learned a lot from them. And so when you start these, you say, do we do the mother of all databases or just minimal database that has a little respondent burden? So they went with the latter. And we were able to first start with hip and knee in the early 2000s. And it didn't really, you have to collect data for a while before you can start putting it together in the form of a question and eventual answers to the questions through the database. And that so hip and knee early, ACL started in 2005. Shoulder arthroplasty was started in 2009, but we were able to retroactively go back and get data from 2005. Hip fracture has been a non-physician run registry, meaning all the first ones I explained, physicians have to fill out a form, and that's the formal entry into the registry is the date of the operation. That form was first paper, and the little staff that Liz Paxton, who went from working for Don in his office and eventually got a PhD from the University of Gothenburg. So, you know, we've seen great expansion of people's own personal stories through the registry. And she, it went from her and Dawn and organizing it. Then later on, Tad Funahashi, who was in a role that I'm in now in Southern California before me, being her physician partner. And now largely I'm kind of one of her closer physician partners. I want Kanu to explain where we've gone more recently, but we just kept adding registries and based on essentially different implants. So that's the kind of the short story of the origin story of the registry.
Maybe you can follow through with how the hip fracture thing started.
Yeah, so I joined Kaiser Permanente in 2013, and mainly because it was the best option out here in Hawaii, where my wife is from. I'd always assumed that I would go to some large academic medical center, but my wife won that argument. And so when I came to Kaiser Permanente, maintained an interest in research, and somebody mentioned, oh, if you're interested in research, you should get in touch with the registry folks. And so I did, and they said, oh, you're interested in trauma, we have a hip fracture registry. I said, you know, I've never heard of the registry, the hip fracture registry. There had been zero papers published out of the registry. And I said, oh, how many patients do you have in this so-called hip fracture registry? They said 20,000. I said, what? And there have been no papers published out of this registry? Okay, what do I need to do? And they said, okay, well, send us a proposal. And so, you know, the first thing we thought of was, is there a relationship between hip fracture volume and outcome? And so I, you know, research background, put together a proposal. I figured they'd send me a database that I could analyze. They sent me back the methods, the results, and the tables. And I said, this is incredible. And so since then, yes, I've done a lot of work out of the hip fracture registry as well as the joint registry. So the hip fracture registry specifically, as Ron mentioned, started in 2009. And at this point in 2023, at last check, had around 75,000 patients. And as Ron mentioned, it's unique in that it runs entirely without physician input. The idea being if you're doing a total joint registry, there's a small number of surgeons where you can say every time you do a hip replacement, knee replacement, fill out this form, whereas hip fractures are done by many surgeons on call who may do just a couple a year, and trying to track them down was a hassle. So any hip fracture that's done within the Kaiser Permanente system is automatically entered into the registry and tracked forever. And it's linked to the Social Security database so that if a patient passes away, that's known whether or not it occurs at a Kaiser Permanente facility or not. Somewhat surprisingly, there's actually very little turnover between insurance companies. So if a patient has their hip fracture surgery at a Kaiser facility at 5 years, it's actually in the single digit percent of patients who are no longer with Kaiser Permanente. So it allows us to have large numbers, essentially complete follow-up on complications and reoperations and mortality, and allows us to answer some interesting questions.
Can I ask a broader question, which probably gets to both of your thinking around the use of registry data? Most registries, at least in my understanding, really haven't ever been developed for research purposes. So as both of you, both being evidence-based, thoughtful, and wanting to use it for research, did you have to work with them at all to say, okay, you know, these are additional things that we're going to need, additional potential safeguards that we're going to need? Or how do you work with a group as you want to try to transform some of the work to be publishable work? You know, and you know, you both are well-versed of all the issues you'd have to overcome to be feeling confident about the data sets you're with. Did you go through any sort of learning curve with them, or did they go through a learning curve with you?
And I'm not sure, Mo, exactly who the they is you're talking about, In my, let me just give you a little bit more background. One of the essential pacts we had with the surgeons, because we require the surgeons to fill out the form. At first it was paper, now it's electronic. So it comes through our Epic product called Health Connect, and it prompts us in the recovery room to fill it out. So it's really nice. It's kind of like a easy reminder. And to the respondent burn, it's less than 90 seconds, like 20 seconds, you can fill out most of these forms. But we always said to the surgeons, we will never use this as a QI on you. So it motivates them to fill it out. We're not going to attack you with your own data. That's for you at your medical center. If there's issues, the QI process will take place, but the registry group will never kind of pinpoint you and go at the data. So as we initially had the registries all paper charts, as we all lived through, all of us are longer in the tooth and remember those days. But then when it went to electronic, we still, the registry teams still have access to the main data that's inputted by the surgeons, or in the case of hip fracture, the essential data that's collected. And then if Kanu asks a special question that requires mining of other Epic data, there's a data warehouse that's throughout the KP system, and our registry teams are really adept at going in and mining that. They don't like to do a ton of extra mining because it does create the write-up of computer code. It's essentially, then they have to validate that they're getting the right data that is needed, et cetera. I don't know if I answered your question, but it evolved over time to have these core set of data plus this other sets of data. And we almost try to never do chart review.
Got it.
Yeah. So thanks, Ron. So my response would be, I think there's kind of two entities to bear in mind. So one is the registry staff. So Liz Paxton as the leader with several PhD level biostatisticians and epidemiologists, as well as several MA and BA level individuals doing the data analysis. So that would be one group. And then the second group is the funders, right? Both play an important role in the direction of the registry. So Ron would know best, but my understanding is that when it was initially founded, it was actually funded by companies, by implant manufacturers. And as that kind of went out of vogue, it became funded by Kaiser, the health insurance company. And recently, there was a shift in, we used to be able to ask any question. More recently, the registries have shifted more towards implant tracking organization. So most of our questions these days tend to be implant focused, as opposed to, for example, as I said earlier, the effect of surgical volume on outcomes. So part of it is doing things that are going to be useful and important to the organization, to essentially a health insurance company. And that's always in the background. But I will say the folks who actually run the registry are extremely sophisticated in research methods. And I did an MPH in clinical epidemiology, and they are way ahead of anything that I would know how to even think of. They're very sophisticated. So the research aspect of things is easy. I think the thing that we're mainly able to contribute as physicians is more the clinical. So what are the interesting questions to ask? What would we expect in terms of confounding, right? So if we're comparing total hips to hemis for fracture, we're going to be able to tell them, listen, the hemi patients are going to be older and sicker, so not directly comparable. Here's what you'll need to do in the analysis to make that comparison. So that's how I would answer that question.
And we want to utilize the registries to change practice inherent to KP and ultimately the world at large. If we have a finding that is pertinent, we try to inculcate that on the administrative side. I have some administrative roles, and Kanu just became the chief of orthopedics in Hawaii. So congratulations, Kanu. That's really great. I say adult babysitting, yeah, right? You both have done a lot of administrative orthopedics. It's like, wow. We want to bring it back to the practice and say, listen, our own registry, and Kanu did a great study recently showing that cemented femurs in the hemiarthroplasty population do a lot better than the cementless. You know, others had shown it, but I think he showed it on a really macro scale. And we want to bring it back. And still, some of our surgeons are recalcitrant to some of the findings. So we just keep working with them. And we kind of track and trend data. We use Hawthorne effect on the administrative side as chiefs to say, guys, this is what it's showing. This is what your shows. We like to use unblinded data. I may have gotten onto a tangent with you all, but I want you to know that we try to not just publish and walk around the academy and say, somebody knows me, I'm on the podium, but to also kind of affect practice change.
Well, I was going to say, some of the studies that we've been doing recently is, just as Ron said, kind of tracking surgeon choices and surgeon behavior in the face of data. So in the ACL realm, in Ron's wheelhouse, it was shown relatively early that allografts did worse than autografts. And there was a massive shift in KP and then eventually outside KP away from allograft. And more recently, as Ron mentioned, so, you know, in the United States, generally, still about 50% of hemis are press fit in the face of, you know, just massive amounts of data to the contrary. And the same was true in our system. But after we published our study, we've seen the rate of cementation go from about 50% to about 80%. And that's, you know, if you look at national trends, it's gone from 50 to like 56, you know. So we have been able to show that behavior change internally, and we're hoping to publish that as well.
That's great. I've got one more question, then I'll let Mo give the final question. But as I mentioned in the introduction, the quality of work coming out of the KP registries is simply outstanding. And my question is, how much do you two think that the culture of orthopedics within the system, the way the orthopedic surgeons are paid with this massive health system, how much does that play into the success of your registry work?
I'll take a little stab at it, and I'd love to hear Kanu's thoughts as well. I do believe that our culture is one, you know, each of the Permanentes are different. So Hawaii Permanente is not Southern California, is not TPMG or the Permanente in Northern California, but we still have a similar culture in that we can't be, by and large, be conflicted. We can't take a lot of industry dollars. So we just are seeking truth with our work. We are just trying to see what the truth is and go for it from there. I would happen to just be on a paper recently with Kanu where, in spite of, you know, we know we should cement femurs, but we looked at cementless and we actually named different brands and different products. We weren't afraid to do that because we don't lose anything with anybody because we're not taking much from anybody. So that's part of the culture. And the other part of it is that the surgeons do, by and large, listen. He gave that 50 to 80%. And I said there was recalcitrance. It was just this small complement of surgeons who still stick to doing cementless femurs in that hypothetical or specific example. But yes, the culture does help the folks to kind of move on findings and act on them and say, you know what, I'm going to do it this way now. I don't lose anything as long as I'm not technically having to relearn the whole operation. Kanu, what are your thoughts?
Oh, no, I think that's right, Ron. I don't know much to add on that one.
If I may just, ask Mark, did you have a follow-up? If not, I'll just ask
the
final.
No, question. I think they answered it well. The culture is important in the success of this work.
I mean, it was interesting hearing you both. So in one take, Kanu, you've done an important piece of work together in which you've seen a pretty significant shift in practice. We talk about impact all the time, and it's one thing to quote a paper, it's another thing to actually change your practice, right? And, if you can demonstrate that, that's hugely powerful. But I also heard, Ron, you talking about the fact that there's still some way to go in getting, you know, our community to accept, you know, the data that comes from these very large data sets in a way that allows them to help them make, you know, important decisions about changing practice. Do you both feel, maybe this is a broader question, but do you feel that the registry data and research on registries and publications have found their place within the hierarchy, or are there still some work that needs to be done to help with that knowledge translation around, you know, where they're most valuable and where they can make the greatest impact?
I think some readers probably say, oh, it's a registry, it's a database study. I really respect things like Pearl Diver and Medicare database sets. And that mine those data sets to produce research, it's valuable, and they cannot go deeper. Our group can go deeper because we know exactly who the patients are who are affiliated with each data point. And in those data sets, you really don't know the patients, so you can't get other stuff. So I would like to, and obviously I'm drinking from my own Kool-Aid, I'd like to say, wow, you should hopefully respect our research because we can go deeper, slightly deeper, and not just throw us into the grab bag of those other pure data sets where there's kind of, you don't know who the patients are, really. They're just big, big roundup numbers. But I still think that probably the average reader just says, oh, it's a registry and a database study, and they bundle them all together. And that might be where some work needs to be done. And hopefully we can find even a better, more influential place in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think a lot of people just lump all database studies together. But, you know, we've done studies recently where we've started doing X-ray review in addition to the database study, and that's feasible. It's possible because all the data is there. I think it's a false dichotomy to say, okay, do we need randomized trials? Do we need registry studies? You know, the reality is we need them all. They show different things. Obviously, Mo and Mark, you all have been real leaders in the orthopedic community in doing randomized trials, and really come from the pure kind of research methodologic standpoint, answering questions, eliminating the effect of confounders, and that's really moved our field forward. And then at the same time, you know, even if you do a massive randomized trial of thousands of patients, you follow for 2 years, you know, 2 years isn't that long in the arthroplasty sphere. And if the difference is, you know, 2% versus 3%, that's 1.5 times, but you may have trouble picking that up even with 1,000 patients. And so I think there is value for studies involving hundreds of thousands of patients that are followed for 20 years. There are other issues you need to think about, confounding, but really it offers kind of a real world, you know, experience similar, which is a complement to the randomized trial data, which is so valuable as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think we need all forms of evidence. I think sometimes the hierarchy forces us to think that there is only one type that's actually valuable, but we need it all. So I think really well put, Kanu. Thanks again, Ron. Mark, as always, great chat with you. And I'll continue to sip away on my coffee and hope you all get a chance to enjoy the rest of your day. Some of you, it's beginning, and for some of us, it's midday. So thanks again.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good talking. Thank you.
Take care.